Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Secretary of State John Kerry has arrived in Kiev to reinforce U.S. support for the new government there as it faces its greatest threat so far by Russian forces in the Crimean Peninsula. President Obama has suspended all military engagements with Russia, which allegedly has sent some 16,000 forces into the region, into that peninsula, since February 24th. Joining us now by phone from Kiev is Washington Post foreign correspondent Will England. Welcome to the show, Will.
Thanks.
All right, so let's talk about forces, troops. What do we mean by 16,000? What's in Crimea?
Well, Russian President Vladimir Putin gave a kind of a relaxed press conference today where he is maintaining that there are no Russian troops outside of their bases in Crimea. There are regular Russian bases in Crimea, but that all these pictures we've seen of men with guns in green uniforms with no insignia, that he said, well, they must be some sort of local defense group or something. I think almost nobody believes that. The vehicles that have been shown with these men all have Russian license plates and not Crimean or Ukrainian license plates. So I think the allegation that about 16,000 Russian troops have come into Crimea as this crisis, you know, began, I see no reason to doubt that. I think they had a lot of people on the ground there, but there are credible reports that more have been added in the last week or so.
What do we know about what's actually happening there anyway? Is there violence? Is it peaceful? What are those forces doing?
It's very dicey. There hasn't been any real violence down there yet. The men in green, let's call them the Russians,
okay.
will show up at Ukrainian military bases, surround the base. What we're hearing from the Ukrainians is that they demand, you know, the surrender of the base or of the weaponry in the base or something like that. Almost in every case, the Ukrainians have refused. The Russians stand there. The Ukrainians stand there. There's, you know, kind of a stare down. Sometimes the Russians leave again. This morning, a group of Ukrainians who were based at a military airfield outside of Sevastopol marched back to the airfield to kind of, you know, claim their position there, not carrying any arms. They had two flags. One was a Ukrainian flag, and the other was a Soviet flag, the flag of a Soviet unit that won a lot of valor during World War II in the Crimea fighting against the Nazis. So I think the message was, you know, are you going to fire upon this flag? Well, the Russians didn't. In the end, they got very close. There was a certain amount of firing, warning shots into the air. But, you know, then there was a standoff. Ukrainians stayed for a while. In the last hour or so, they mostly now retreated again from the airfield, but still no fighting, but still a great fear of provocation or somebody doing something dumb or whatever that could set off a spark. And that's what people are really concerned about.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Washington Post foreign correspondent Will England. He is in Kiev right now. Secretary of State John Kerry has arrived. Tell us, he brought with him $1 billion. What does all of that mean? Who is he talking with, and what is he offering?
Well, he's offering, as you say, $1 billion, which is, not nothing in a country like Ukraine. The Ukrainians calculate that they need something on the order of $25 to $35 billion over the course of this year in order to kind of get their economy, not to get their economy in shape, but to maintain the state in a sense. The new government, just in power since last week, is arguing that the previous government under Viktor Yanukovych, you know, drained the coffers. There's no money. Yanukovych had, before he was his parliamentary elections a little over a year ago, had raised pensions and salaries and that sort of thing. So, and had no means of paying it. And now, you know, the treasury is dry. Ukraine is looking for short-term and long-term loans from the International Monetary Fund, also looking for help from the European Union. So $1 billion is $1 billion. It's as I said, it's not nothing, but it is kind of an initial token amount toward assistance. Kerry also said that the United States will be imposing sanctions later this week against Russian officials. I don't think he qualified that. I think if Russia suddenly withdrew all its forces from the Crimea, he would back down. But they're talking about visa and financial sanctions against people in what they call the chain of command involved in this crisis.
Now, Reuters is reporting that Russian Navy ships have blocked off the Kerch Strait, which separates Ukraine's Crimea region and Russia, according to the Ukrainian Border Guard Service. And the Russian military has not confirmed his comments. Of course, their entire Black Sea Fleet is stationed there, right?
The Black Sea Fleet is the Kerch Strait is on the eastern side of the Crimean Peninsula.
Okay.
The Black Sea Fleet is actually in Sevastopol, which is on the southwestern edge of the peninsula. Both the Ukrainian fleet and the Russian fleet are there. The Kerch obviously provides a means for Russians to enter into the Crimea without having to cross it, you know, Ukraine, a great deal of Ukrainian territory. So they see that as a strategic thing. Yesterday, Men in Green seized the ferry terminal on the Ukrainian side. And interestingly, yesterday, Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev of Russia announced that Russia needed to go ahead with plans to build a bridge across the strait. Now, obviously, this is something that would be several years in the making, but it may have been an attempt at sending a signal that, you know, we're planning on staying here and we're gonna hold on to this area.
What about civilians? How are they responding to this?
Well, my colleague in the Crimea, William Booth of the Washington Post, reports that the civilians are, as you might expect, have differing opinions. There's a lot of support for Russia there. It's an entirely Russian-speaking part of Ukraine. It was never historically part of Ukraine before 1954, when it was transferred from the Russian Soviet Federation to the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. And so people are enthusiastic about Russia and Russians, and they're also, there's a fair amount of hostility toward what they see as these, as these usurpers who have taken power in Kiev. That said, the new prime minister of the Republic of Crimea is a man who won 4% of the vote in the last election, running on a reunite with Russia platform. So there isn't a lot of support for that. The other big factor is something more than a quarter of the population are Crimean Tatars. They're an old Muslim group that have lived there for, you know, over 1,000 years, and they're very, very hostile to Moscow because of their history of relations with the Russians, and they very much want to stay with Ukraine. So that's an additional factor going on here.
You wrote recently about why Ukraine is a prize for Russia and Europe, and besides the fact that Russia bases its Black Sea Fleet in Crimea, which would not be logical if Ukraine joins NATO, what is the draw of Ukraine?
Well, it's there are a couple of factors. One is that Russia would very much like to get control of the natural gas pipelines that run across Ukraine, which would allow it to have sort of total control of all the gas lines feeding natural gas from Russia and from Central Asia into Europe. They have tried to put pressure on the Ukrainian companies to gain control over them and hadn't succeeded yet. So that's probably an element here. A bigger element is that President Putin has been putting together what will be called the Eurasian Economic Union, and it includes Russia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and just recently Armenia agreed to join. And his whole point is that we're going to be an economic bloc, and our values and our standards are different from those in the West. We're a different culture, and we're going to, you know, all be together. There is a element of kind of Eastern Slavic ethnic appeal to it, even though the Kazakhs and the Armenians are not Slavs. Most people believe that including Ukraine in this group would actually make it a significant group. You, in a sense, almost be reconstructing the Soviet Union. And having Ukraine outside of the group, having it particularly linked to Europe, really kind of undercuts Putin's whole argument. So I think that's a big factor in his thinking.
When I ask questions like this, I know that, you can't, there's no way to respond to it with some kind of one size fits all. But how do Ukrainians view outside interference at this point by the U.S. or the EU?
Well, there's, of course, the people in the government are appealing for help from the U.S. and the EU. Another colleague of mine, Carol Morello, was talking to some self-defense guys from the, you know, we used to call them the opposition. Now they're the sort of supporting the parties in power. But the people who were out protesting these past 3 months on the Maidan, and they were saying, you know, if it came to war, Ukraine could not beat Russia by itself. But if we had help from the United States and the European Union, you know, we could lick them. I think that, you know, is extremely unlikely. But that's the attitude. Now, of course, you have people on the sort of pro-Russian side, or at least the anti-European Western side, who feel exactly the opposite and, you know, would be horrified at the thought of Europeans coming into Ukraine in any kind of significant way. There was a anti-Maidan protester I talked with in January who was saying, you know, the last time the Europeans tried to join with Ukraine was in 1941 when the Germans attacked the Soviet Union and they, you know, they invaded and took us over. We don't want to see that history, you know, repeated. Well, that's not, of course, what the EU is talking about, but that's an attitude that's out here. Now, the other side of the coin, the new interior minister, today said there was a third force at work in the most violent days of the protests on the Maidan, the days when up to maybe 90 people were killed, most of them shot dead. And he's saying and it was a non-Ukrainian force. Now, he didn't mention the Russians, but that's obviously what he has in mind. And he said, we're going to investigate the origins of that. So that's a different kind of outside interference.
And speaking of the Maidan, what's going on there now? Are there still demonstrations, or is that all settled up? And
I was just there. There's still quite a lot of people there. It's very foggy, misty, smoky atmosphere there today. People are there still in part. On Sunday, there was a kind of a big rally, you know, waving the flag, denouncing Putin, denouncing the Russians. But the permanent camp is still there, and it's because people who led these protests really don't trust the parliament, known as the Verkhovna Rada, to do things right. It's the same old politicians. It's the politicians who are on their side, in a sense. But they're people who are part of the system. And so you have it's getting to be a little bit more hardcore down in the Maidan now. And there's people who really want to say, you know, this is a revolution. We want to change the system, not just the faces.
So Ukraine's acting president has been in communication with Ukraine's military commanders in Crimea. How are they working together?
You know, that's an excellent question. There's no way for Ukraine to kind of resupply, you know, the commanders down there. Most of the units are, as I was mentioning earlier, surrounded by men in green, the Russian forces. You know, it reminds me a little bit of what was it? Colonel Anderson, was that his name, at Fort Sumter in 1861, surrounded by Confederate forces, and there was no way for the Union to, you know, to resupply the fort. I think an awful lot of people here are hoping that there is not a bombardment of the Ukrainian bases the way there was at Fort Sumter. But it's not an immediate problem, but it's going to be a problem.
Will England, thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Well, England, he's foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. Coming up, we're going to talk to a couple of political scientists about what's been happening, what's led up to this, and what the options are going forward. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Yesterday, President Obama outlined how his administration will respond to Russia's actions in Ukraine.
If, in fact, they continue on the current trajectory that they're on, that we are examining a whole series of steps, economic, diplomatic, that will isolate Russia and will have a negative impact on Russia's economy and its status in the world.
Joining us by phone from Delaware County is author and political scientist Sean Kay of Ohio Wesleyan University. Sean is Mershon Associate at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at OSU. His forthcoming book is entitled America's Search for Security, The Triumph of Idealism and the Return of Realism. Welcome back to the show, Sean.
Good morning.
Also joining us in the studio is political scientist and director of the Russian and Central Eurasian Studies Program at Wittenberg University, Jerry Hudson. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Nice to be with you today.
Sean Kay, you've written recently about the dilemma for America in Ukraine, in particular that Russia is behaving as some scholars have predicted and expected since the end of the Cold War.
Yes, that's right. I mean, when I worked in the Defense Department at the very first round of NATO enlargement in the mid-1990s for a brief period, and while many of us thought there was a very reasonable argument for bringing in the first round of members of NATO that we did, we were all also, many experts outside too, were concerned at the time that it should never go too far to the point where it would be seen from the Russian perspective as threatening. And we have to understand the context here. If we want to understand our adversary in Putin, we have to understand the context in which we're operating here. And I do believe there are a number of levers we can pull that would be effective. I don't think they're going to be effective of getting them out of Crimea, but perhaps dissuading them from doing anything else at this stage. But what we don't want to do is put fuel on the fire. From the Russian perspective, as illegitimate as what they've done is, they have seen us do things in their immediate backyard and neighborhood that we would never for a minute tolerate in our own. And that's been going on for about 20 years now. People have been warning about the Crimea for a long time, and that has not effectively been registered as in terms of how we've calculated our interest in terms of how the Russians are viewing theirs.
We mentioned earlier, I should say, Will England mentioned earlier that Crimea became part of Ukraine not until 1954. It was made a country in 1991 after the fall of the Soviet Union. How much does this newness, really a relative newness, sort of this artificiality of this country, affect how it responds in crises like this, Jerry?
Yeah, well, of course, Ukraine is a new country, and now, of course, they're saddled with a government made up mostly of amateurs. Remember that the current government, the one that's been in place for about a week, is the result of an anti-constitutional overthrow of the democratically elected government. And actually, this is one of the principal arguments that Russia can bring to the table. Look, the people that we're working with here haven't been chosen democratically by Ukrainians. Ukraine has had this problem of ineffective leadership ever since it was first founded as a country and in 1991. And they just haven't been able to build very effective institutions, at least institutions that are not incredibly corrupt.
So, Sean Kay, then, how do they withstand the pressures, the stresses of something that they're going through now?
The new government?
Yeah.
Well, my hope is one of the pressures that comes is today from Secretary of State Kerry. This needs to be done quietly and privately, but we also need to be direct with them that they have also a role to play here in ensuring that this does not escalate. Our interests in this lie in it not escalating any further whatsoever. And the new government, I believe, made some initial mistakes. They should have focused on consolidating power, moving towards elections, getting IMF loans. They did not do one of the first things they needed to do, which was to reach out and reassure the many millions of Russians living in eastern Ukraine that they would be a government for all of Russia. That's not to say that they're to blame. Putin is responsible for what Putin does here.
But they did do almost the opposite by starting to ban the use of Russian language, or what did they do?
They pulled back on that wisely, but putting an arrest warrant out for the person the Russians felt had been negotiated to be the interim president of Ukraine until the March elections, you know, probably wasn't helpful at the, in that heated moment. Again, I want to be careful here because I think Putin is responsible for Putin's actions and mm-hmm. going after his prestige and his sense of importance in the world. I think he's actually really hurting Russia's interest in what he's doing here. I think this is an overreach. I don't think it's going to be sustainable. They can hold on to Crimea. They've basically been in charge of Crimea all this time anyway. So, But their military is still very weak, and the pressures that we can put on them, we have to be very careful how we calibrate this so as not to inadvertently feed right into his narrative that it's us who've been encroaching into their area and that they are on the defense.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. So the main goal, what should the main goal be, Jerry Hudson, right now for the U.S.?
It must be to avoid civil war in Ukraine. Above all, that's the most important thing. Ukraine, remember, is a country of 45 million people, and it's under siege in many ways. And we have got to, and Sean is absolutely right here, prevent any accidents from happening. In a situation like this, accidents often do happen that lead to unintended violence, and the whole thing can devolve into a civil conflict. We've got to look at this very soberly from the U.S. point of view, and I hope very much that the Russians are also doing that from their point of view. I don't think that they want an unstable Ukraine. I don't think the Russians want civil war in Ukraine. I would be shocked if, in fact, they were to send troops into Ukraine proper. But things like this happen, and I can only keep my fingers crossed.
Sean Kay?
The dilemma is if the Russian populations in eastern areas of Ukraine themselves would vote to leave Ukraine and join Russia, what would happen then? Because once you get out of Crimea, the ethnic mix is a little more complicated, and that's where it could get kind of messy. And so I think the real question here is what kind of measures can be taken that will really demonstrate to Putin that he himself would be the big loser in that kind of escalation. And we have to be careful, again, not to feed into his narratives inadvertently. For example, in my view, any talk of you know, NATO exercises in the Baltics or in Poland, as nice as that would be to reassure those countries, that would feed right into Putin's narrative about what's going on here. It would actually embolden him, likely, and perhaps contribute to the exact scenario that Jerry is pointing to correctly. I think there are other levers that we can and should pull, and we can detail that later. But the immediate thing is, you know, we don't want to pour gasoline on a fire here. And in many ways, you know, this is evidence that our approach to this whole entire region over the last 20 years has, at least in this case, run into a major failure. We need to be careful to at least calibrate our response, as Jerry said, in a very sober way that doesn't pile onto that.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about the latest ongoing crisis in Ukraine. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So the idea is that Russia just wants to control Ukraine in so much as it's where it leans economically and politically, but it doesn't want to run Ukraine.
Right. I think running Ukraine could create a huge host of problems for Russia, given the enormous corruption.
But it wants to control everything it does.
Well, they certainly want Ukraine to be clearly within Russia's sphere of influence, which isn't necessarily a bad thing at all for the Ukrainians or for the Russians. But to what extent does Russia want to control Ukraine? That's the question. I would like to bring up another point here, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. One of the players in this whole exercise that we haven't mentioned yet is Germany. Germany, it seems to me, is the most critical country that could come in and play a really constructive role in keeping things below the level of civil war. Germany is a huge trading partner with Russia. Apparently, Russia and Germany get along well with each other. Merkel and Putin talk to each other, auf Deutsch, and so on. So there is a chance for Angela Merkel in particular to play a key role here.
Can I add to that?
Yes.
I think the other thing where we have to be very sober about this is that the facts of the matter are, whether we like it or not, there's no solution to our position in Afghanistan without the Russians involved. There's no solution to Iran and its nuclear program without the Russians involved. There's no solution to Syria without the Russians involved. You know, we have to look at a broad set of interests here. I think we need to go bigger than Germany. I think that I'm arguing we should pull the old Nixon-Kissinger China card here on the Russians. And John Kerry should have gone to Kiev, but confused Putin by first stopping in Beijing. And, you know, Ukraine owes Beijing about $3 billion worth of wheat. The Chinese are very committed and consistent on this issue of sovereignty. And it's not that we need a lot from China right now, but if we just keep Putin off his guard, there was a massive capital flight out of Russia yesterday. Their economy took a massive hit for this. People around Putin are going to say, whoa, wait a minute, we're losing our money. and just that additional bit of leverage, we have to think carefully about geostrategic pivot points here as to where we press this and how we press this. Unfortunately, we don't seem to do complexity very well here, and we need to think about this in a much more creative way than sort of some kind of linear response that might actually inadvertently make the situation worse.
You know, I have mentioned how the Ukrainians are responding, how residents of the Crimean Peninsula are responding to this. We're talking about it in the United States, but what about people in Russia? How are they responding to this? Does anybody know or care?
Sure. Public opinion polls have consistently shown that Russians support what Putin is doing. Many of them, I think it's the plurality in one of the latest public opinion polls that I have seen, say that they believe that what's going on in Maidan is the result of Western influence, that the West is somehow in there cooking things around and leading the opposition. So Putin is winning a lot of domestic political points, at least in the short term for this. However, as Sean correctly points out, in the longer term, things might not look so good for him, especially if the oligarchs, the very wealthiest Russians, start losing significant money as a result of Russian actions.
And one other element to that is that, you know, we talk about like Obama's credibility on Syria and his red lines and things like that. Putin has laid out red lines on Ukraine and Georgia for a very long time. So did Yeltsin before him. This is not, you know, unique to Putin in that regard. Mm-hmm. And the Russian military, since 1992, has had a doctrine where they say they're going to defend the interests of 22 million Russians living outside of Russia, including the use of military capabilities. Now, we ignored that, and we went ahead as if that was not important to us. And so, again, Putin is responsible for Crimea, but it will be our mistake if we fail to recognize this context in terms of how we calibrate our response and our interest to this.
David in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, David.
Hi, interesting show. I appreciate you doing this. I guess you've already touched on the NATO issues, but how are we obliged to reduce military pressures by reducing I don't even know why NATO exists still, but by reducing those kind of pressures and then also by working more with the native peoples. I think there's a variety of peoples in Ukraine. I think the eastern Ukraine's more tied to Russia and western Ukraine's mm-hmm. more tied to Poland in mm-hmm. some ways. But it's more of a complex issue, and I don't think it's just one thing. What do your experts think?
Well, I can take the NATO piece, and And it's something I've worked on for a long time now. And you know, an original enlargement of NATO to include Poland, I believe, made sense because it centered that piece of territory between Germany rising and Russia in decline. But we kind of turned it into more of a Wilsonian sort of democracy building project. And started to believe that what we were doing, quite appropriate in our view, was entirely reasonable and legitimate, and it was, because we were talking about using this to consolidate reform in this part of the world. But the Russians were looking at it through a realpolitik, geopolitics view, and we kind of failed to calculate for that in our own perspectives. What concerns me right now is that I'm seeing arguments in the Washington Post and other places where and in major media where the first question is, well, what should NATO's response be? And you know, we can do things. I would, for example, put an American naval exercise right near the Turkish Straits in the Baltic Sea. I'm not saying we should do nothing here. But as we view NATO as a benign force, the Russians view it as an enemy alliance of military intervention seeking to infringe on what they see as their vital interests. And if we fail to understand that, we will take moves that will exacerbate the situation. It's that part we need to calculate for very wisely, and I think we need to think about other venues and avenues in which we can approach this issue. And I don't think any of these avenues are likely to get the Russians out of Crimea, if that's the objective. The question now is how to dissuade them from going further.
Right. I would agree with Sean on that. I think that the Crimean thing is lost. But getting back to what the questioner asked about the complexity, yeah, it's very complex because it's more than just a segment of the population being pro-West and one being pro-Russia and all that jazz. There was a huge underlying tenor of the protest against corruption in Ukraine.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And that cut across all groups. Groups that were in the West, but groups that were in the East and pro-Russian, they didn't like the corruption either. And so it's not just as simple as pro or anti-Russian. And I think Putin would like to turn it into that. And so part of our objective is to try to prevent that from happening. I think it would be bad news.
My guests, Sean Kay, political scientist at Ohio Wesleyan University, also Mershon Associate at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at OSU. His forthcoming book is entitled America's Search for Security, The Triumph of Idealism and the Return of Realism. Also with us, George Husson, recently retired political scientist from Wittenberg University. He lectures now at Ohio State University and is a faculty affiliate of OSU's Mershon Center for International Security Studies. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. President Obama has labeled the Russian advance in Crimea a violation of international law, and he has urged Congress to approve an aid package for the Ukrainian government. Secretary of State John Kerry arrived there today with $1 billion for starters. The president has also repeated earlier threats that the U.S. would take economic steps against Russia and isolate it diplomatically if Russian President Vladimir Putin does not back down. But some in Congress want the U.S. to take a more aggressive approach to relations with Russia. Here's what Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona said yesterday.
The President of the United States believes that the Cold War is over. That's fine. It is over. But Putin doesn't believe it's over. He doesn't believe that that this is a zero-sum game. Look at Moldova. Look at the occupation of Georgia. Look at the pressure on the Baltic nations. Look at what they're doing in assisting Bashar Assad slaughter tens of thousands of innocent people in cities and towns and countryside all over Syria. It is an outrage.
Once again, that was U.S. Senator John McCain of Arizona. Still with me, Jerry Hudson. And Sean Kay, two political scientists. We've talked before, and we welcome your questions or comments, 614-292-8513. So Sean Kay, is John McCain alone in his fear that the president's not taking this seriously enough and that they're not taking the threat of Putin seriously enough, given what we know about his past?
I think it's more of a cognitive dilemma that we have engaged in ways that we think are completely reasonable, and I think are reasonable myself, you know, in the Russian sphere of influence. But the Russians don't see it that way. But ironically, you know, John McCain has been a major advocate of exactly that approach for some time now. And so I see that, again, as a rather linear approach to the problem. Now, the problem here is historical. It's cognitive from their perspective. There's 22 million Russians living outside of Russia. Look, none of that justifies what Putin has done here. What Putin has done here is a violation of international law. The question is, how do we get around dealing with it? I believe that the solution is to go right at the heart of the matter, which is Putin himself. He sees himself, fancies himself as someone who stirs up problems and then comes in as a problem solver. He wants to be seen in the world as an important guy, right? As an important figure, somebody who's respected, and restoring this sense of humiliation and loss that the Russians had at the end of the Cold War. He needs to be painted now as a pariah for what he is, and we can do that. But the classic origins of containment, as George Kennan saw them in 1947 and 48, were really going to be geographic and political. People like Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger got it exactly right. You solve the problem in Europe by going to China. And we seem to have lost almost an ability to think in geostrategic terms and how we formulate our thinking on these things, because we've been really locked in on sort of this sort of liberal interventionist and neoconservative assumptions about our place in the world without realizing that other countries are acting very much in classic realpolitik terms. And if they're going to act that way, then we shouldn't be surprised when they do. This is an entirely predictable crisis. It astonishes me that I heard Anderson Cooper on CNN last night say that nobody could have predicted this crisis or something like that. And I thought, really? Because people have been predicting it for 20 years now.
Well, Sean's right about this, and what I don't want to a point of his to get lost in this conversation is the business about China and going to China and talking to Beijing, just the fact of doing that is going to make Putin a little bit nervous. But let's also not forget Kazakhstan. In the northern part of Kazakhstan live a lot of Russians, and I can't imagine that the Kazakh government is really comfortable with what the Russians are doing either. There is an organization called the Shanghai Cooperation Conference, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, of which Russia is a member, China is a member, Kazakhstan is a member. And in 2008, when Russia tried to get its intervention in Georgia recognized and rubber-stamped by that organization, the SCO wouldn't do it. And I suspect that Russia won't even try to have that done this time. I would be very surprised if it did, because I'm sure China and Kazakhstan would strongly object.
The other reason this is so important is because we would be naive to think that Russia doesn't have levers it can pull back, and some of them are powerful economic ones. There's a great amount of mutual dependency on natural gas going into Western Europe. Mm-hmm. About one-third of the EU's natural gas comes out of Russia. Now, Russians need the money that the EU spends on that, but the EU needs the gas, as so does Ukraine as well. And if this really were to start to escalate, even in terms of sanctions and whatnot, and I'm not opposed to, you know, economic pain here being put on Putin by any means. That's a reasonable approach at this point. But we should be very clear-eyed that we will have to be prepared to bear some significant costs. Jerry rightly pointed, you know, we're talking about $1 billion in aid, perhaps, for the government in Kyiv. We're going to need many, many tens of billions of dollars of aid for government in Kyiv. So the American public needs to be aware of this. We need to think it through. I've had people asking me, when did we make a commitment to defend the Baltic countries? I said, well, that was back about 15 years ago, and we might have wanted to have that conversation at the time then. I was working in the State Department at the time, and people were actually pleased that there wasn't a national discussion of that because they didn't really want to get into that. You know, what do we do if we have to defend the Baltic countries? And now we're in this position where we have to think about that. And so, you know, but Russia has, you know, they can complicate our lives on areas of vital interest to us, especially Iran. And so we have to be very cognizant as we go forward. And this, I think the president has handled this so far exactly as any president would. And I find it unsettling that we see some people, at least through the media, wanting to score some political points at a time of crisis. I think that's very unfortunate. The president's handling this wisely so far and calibrating the response. The messaging is we can ratchet this up or we can ratchet it down. Which direction do you want to go in here, Putin?
I agree, Sean. I think you've made a very good point about President Obama's policy so far, and I hope he keeps this kind of a line going, just ratcheting things up gradually and leaving room for Russia to back down or to change its mind. I get the feeling that in some ways Russian policy here is almost tactical. In other words, Putin seems to be making things up as he goes along. I keep thinking about his images back at the Olympics, the kind of kindly leader going to the, you know, various camps of the various teams and so on, and thinking to myself, you mean he already had this all planned? This usually isn't the way foreign policy is made anyway, and I suspect that Putin is kind of tactical in his approach in some ways anyway.
In his way.
But I'm sorry, Jerry, go ahead.
And we could use this, if that's true, as a way to try to find some spaces where we can talk about ways that Russia needn't proceed further.
Yeah.
Bill in Cleveland, you're on the air. Hi, Bill.
Hi. excuse me. I just wanted to, you know, mention some points. First of all, I'd like to agree with the president. He's doing the right thing, not ratcheting it up, but trying to defuse it. We don't need to ratchet up because we want to get along, not fight and be wrong and maybe touch off World War III, which is possible.
Okay. Let's just take that issue, Bill. World War III, is that possible?
I don't think so. I don't know what Sean would say, but I think that that likelihood is far away. There is, after all, nuclear deterrence.
Yeah, I'm not practicing the duck and cover drills.
Okay.
And frankly, I would also add, the Russian military is very weak. Their capacity to project power into Georgia was coordinated. It was precise. It was a well-organized operation, but it was very thin.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that the Russians are going to restore the Russian Empire with military invasions, they would be overstretched so fast that they would collapse from within. And so again, we really have to be realist about this. We have to look at their capabilities and their tactics. You know, and I think Jerry's right about. I believe, that the tactic here on Crimea is political. They're putting their foot down very inappropriately and saying, whatever the future of Ukraine is going to be, we're going to be a part of it. The dilemma is, especially with regard to those eastern provinces, there is no future solution to Ukraine without the Russians being a part of it. And so that's where we're going to have to see some very savvy and very creative diplomacy going forward, because as we've rightly said, we don't want to see this escalate. And my guess is Jerry's right, and I'm willing to concede this could be completely wrong, but I can't really imagine that a calculating Putin wants to see this collapse into some kind of major chaos on his borders, because the Russians also fear anarchy. And so stability is something that we can appeal to as we move forward in a reasonable way that calculates our interests in terms of how they are also perceiving theirs.
Greg in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Greg.
Yeah, hi there. I actually exchanged an email with Dr. K yesterday about this issue.
Oh, hi, Greg. Yeah.
Hi. Mackinder, Alfred Mackinder, one of the great geopolitical thinkers, talked about the heartland theory and that whoever would control all of Eurasia could control the world. Obviously, that was something that America took pretty seriously through the Cold War vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, that and Spikeman and the Rhineland stuff theory. But here's a concern that I have is going too far against Russia and even attempting to play the reverse Nixon Kissinger by using China, or I guess not really reverse Nixon Kissinger, but using the same tactic of Beijing against Russia. What isn't there a fear that Russia and China will continue to have an embrace? They've already had quite a bit of a relationship. There's inherent tensions there in the East, in Siberia, that should be a problem for Russia long term. But if we continue to create this image of Western aggression through NATO expansion and things that you've talked about before, don't we actually risk running them into each other's embrace and creating a real problem that actually goes to the reverse of anything that, that traditional geopolitics would want relative to the whole Eurasian landmass?
Well, this is why we need to get back to studying, you know, geopolitics. And we've had this kind of vision sort of this liberal and neoconservative worldview that's dominated for 20 years. And somehow in the process, we appear to have lost the ability to think geopolitically like a Kissinger would or a Kennan or something like that. And your point is an important one. The Russians have positioned themselves as trying to be the go-between, perhaps. They could signaling to us, look, we can cooperate with you, the United States, or we can turn to China. Which do you want? That they've been signaling that for some time. What both Russia and China have come to agreement on is that they have declared that they want to advance a situation where it's a multipolar world, not a unipolar world with America calling the shots, right? And ironically, that's the thing that has done that has kind of brought these two very unnatural allies to some accommodation over the last 20 years. We need to break that, and that's why I say, you know, we should be, you know, we have real interest in Asia, real interest in China. We have peripheral interest in Ukraine. We should be using this as an opportunity to reach out to China. And as Jerry said, just even the action of doing that would send a message that would get Putin off his stride here. So my argument is that's the right card to play. The counter argument would be we should be making deals with Russia so we can use them to better contain China. I believe that the depth of our economic relationship, with China is so important that versus the minuscule relationship we have with Russia, that we don't really have a lot of options in that regard. So, you know, again, we need to be cultivating that relationship and use this as an opportunity also to reaffirm China's commitment to respect other people's sovereignty at the same time.
Absolutely right. And we shouldn't make too much of warming ties between Russia and China. There are real limits, not that Sean was doing that, but that sometimes we tend to assume that Russia and China have a lot in common. And that's actually, I think, less there than meets the eye. In terms of the relationship, the Chinese are calling the shots, not the Russians.
Okay. Greg, we have time for just one more quick call. Kerry in Clintonville, you're on the air. We just got about a minute left.
Hi there. I just wanted to know, both of your guests have a wonderful international perspective on the situation. Do you feel that Speaker Kerry has a good enough non-U.S.-centric approach? Is that something that's going to be a strength for him?
Secretary of State Kerry, right?
Well, I think his job is to have a U.S.-centric approach. I think that Secretary Kerry has been doing a very good job in the Middle East. He's working really, really hard, and I'm kind of heartened that he's in Kiev right now. Sean?
Yeah, he's done an effective job as a diplomat. I mean, he's accomplished more, frankly, in the last year than his predecessor did. And I don't mean that as a criticism of his predecessor. I just think he's been willing to go out and really build direct diplomatic ties. He's got a very good line to Lavrov, who's the Russian foreign minister. They will have been talking directly, privately. There's a lot going on that we're not seeing right now. And as I said, I believe so far the Obama administration has handled this as close to as much as any other administration would handle it. And now's the time not to be challenging it.
Okay. I want to thank everybody for listening. Thanks to Jerry Hudson, retired recently from Wittenberg University, now lectures at Ohio State. He's also a faculty affiliate at OSU's Mershon Center for International Security Studies, where Sean Kay is as well. And Sean is also a political scientist professor at the Department of Politics and Government at Ohio Wesleyan University. Thanks, Sean, for joining us again.
Thank you.
And Jerry, thanks as well to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.